And if genetics can help us better understand who's at risk to develop a symptom or better understand the underlying biological mechanisms that puts them at risk, and from there develop interventions to mitigate that risk, why wouldn't neuroscientists do that? Why leave it up to other disciplines to finish the story?
Welcome to Clinical Appraisal, a podcast about nursing science with a focus on methodology. I'm your host, Ian Lane. All opinions shared are my own, and none of this information constitutes medical or nursing advice. This podcast is for educational purposes only. If you would like to make a donation in support of my efforts to continue this show, please visit paypal.me/clinicalappraisal. If you would like to ask a question or share a comment, please email me at clinicalappraisal@gmail.com. Today I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing Dr. Yvette Conley. Yvette is an internationally renowned scientist in the field of nursing research. Classically trained in human molecular genetics, Yvette has contributed significantly to the basic science of nursing in the realm of symptom development for greater than two decades. She has mentored some of the best nurse scientists in the field and is just an overall pleasant person to interact with. Yvette was the first geneticist to become a tenure-track professor in a school of nursing in the United States at University of Pittsburgh, where she still works today in a fully functional omics laboratory within Pitt's School of Nursing. And I believe she was also the first non-nurse scientist to be inducted as a fellow of the American Academy of Nursing. Her research interests revolve around the development of symptoms, with a particular focus on traumatic brain injury, cancer, and stroke. Yvette has won innumerable awards for her work in fundamental nursing research. She sits on various committees, including the National Advisory Council for Nursing Research. She runs the nursing PhD program at U of Pitt, but through it all appears to value most her contribution to the development of other nurse scientists. It was clear to me during the conversation that she harbors an immense respect for her mentorship responsibilities, both with undergraduate and graduate students. Yvette and I talk about topics ranging from the utility of omics for nursing science and practice to the details of her work specifically. I was honored to have the chance to speak with her, and I hope to have her back on again another time soon as I continue to follow her important work. Please enjoy this wonderful episode with Dr. Yvette Conley. I'm here with Yvette Conley. Yvette, it's so nice to finally meet you. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this with me today.
My pleasure.
So you might dispute this, but you are truly beloved by so many people in our community. I have spoken to several faculty across the country who really value the work that you've done. I recently interviewed one of your recent students, now Dr. Teresa Kolek. You have a really large cadre of people who think very highly of your work. And so I feel very grateful that you've joined me for the podcast. Can you give listeners kind of an introduction to who you are and what are your main interests?
Okay, sure. So I just to sort of introduce myself by way of, you know, education and what sort of brought me here, I have a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's degree in genetic counseling. My PhD is in human genetics, and I did my postdoc in molecular genetics. As I was finishing up my postdoc, I was looking for faculty positions, and one of the faculty positions that was available locally was this faculty position in the School of Nursing. And at that time, they were looking for someone with genetics expertise to come to the School of Nursing, develop curriculum in genetics, and bring research, the molecular genetic research to the School of Nursing. They had recently built a wet lab that was sort of sitting there waiting for someone to use it. And when they were not getting folks to apply for that position that were PhD prepared nurses, they started to look elsewhere. And that's when I was turned on to the opening. I reached out and, they brought me in for an interview. That was 21 years ago. I was offered the faculty position here at the University of Pittsburgh School of Nursing. And it is the only faculty position that I've ever held in my career. So I came on as an assistant professor, developed the curriculum in genetics that we now require of our undergrad students, our graduate students, postdoc trainees. I also opened up and built a fully equipped molecular genomics laboratory within the School of Nursing. And I started to build my program of research as an independent scientist. And that trajectory, that career trajectory, that research trajectory, sort of took a slight turn a little bit from what I had originally thought I would be doing. And a lot of that had to do with when I came to the School of Nursing and got immersed into some of the research that was going on in the school. It dawned on me that as a classically trained geneticist, we were mostly interested in, what's the genetic mechanism behind a particular disease, for example, where a lot of my nurse colleagues in the School of Nursing were not so much interested in, that as much as, well, I have patients that have these chronic conditions. I have patients that have had a neurologic injury like stroke or brain injury. I have these patients. However, I know that I can't treat them all the same way because when I do, we still get varied outcomes. We still get varied recovery trajectories in these patients. We still have some patients who respond well to this intervention and some who don't. And as a geneticist, my answer to a lot of that variability is the genetics, the variability in the omic makeup of an individual that comes into that situation and then goes into the recovery period. So I started to build a program of research that was very different from a lot of geneticists, where I was, becoming more interested in, okay, what about symptom development within the context of these chronic conditions? What about that variability and recovery trajectory that a patient following brain injury or stroke experiences? How can we use our omics toolbox to better understand those sorts of phenotypes? And the nursing research community here at the School of Nursing, University of Pittsburgh, really had a profound effect on my my career trajectory.
That's fantastic. And it's such a unique story, which is one of the reasons why I appreciate it so much. Before we get too deep, I wonder if you might just offer a brief description of how you see or how you would define omics for listeners who aren't necessarily aware.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think a lot of people are used to the words genetics and genomics. Genomics is it has more breadth than genetics. So when someone says genetics, they're usually talking about, we're looking at a gene, for example, whereas genomics is where we're looking at someone's whole genome, instead of just one gene. So when we think about omics, we're talking about these sort of, breadth of science where we're looking at, genomics, transcriptomics, proteomics, epigenomics, microbiome, mm-hmm. These are sort of breadth. We're talking about, coverage is large. We're looking at these sort of large swaths of data to help us understand the variability in patient outcomes that we see. So with omics, it could be anything. And if you think about, economics, which is also in omics, you're really talking about breadth of a field, right? So with omics, we're talking about, breadth of a field where we, look at things from the variability in the sequence of the gene right on up to chemical modifications of DNA as a result of interactions with the environment, gene expression, microbiome, anything along those lines that are looking at sort of, the whole picture of omics.
So typically this is where I ask people to describe how they got into nursing, and you have such a unique story. You talked a little bit about your trajectory so far. Is there anything that you left out that you want to talk about in terms of your experience kind of getting into Pitt and identifying your... So to me, the reason I ask if there's anything kind of residual is I feel as though the comments you made about like a more traditional genetics path in science looks a little different for a lot of your colleagues. How do you think about the development of your research program from this unique kind of vantage point that you've built as you got into Pitt's nursing department and sort of created this novel lab?
Right. So I think, I would be remiss if I didn't also, bring up the fact that I spent a lot of time also trying to, help future nurse scientists figure out their way as far as their research trajectories. And so it has been eye-opening, to be part of nursing, someone who's come into nursing from a different discipline and see, how nurse scientists have been, educated and trained and thinking about how I could contribute to their development. So for me, part of this career development and, this trajectory that I've experienced is, the research is one part of it, but the mentoring and the fostering of future nurse scientists has been probably, it's certainly been one of the most rewarding experiences of my career.
I want to talk a little bit about what you see as being the unique contribution of the work you do to nursing. And so what do you feel nursing stands to gain from the omics work in particular? And is it distinct at all from what medicine typically stands to gain from some of this work?
Okay. So this is a good question, right? So, and of course this is going to be, one person's thoughts. I'm sure there are other thoughts that folks might have, but, to me, I've always seen omics as, expanding the nurse scientist toolbox, right? So we're adding things to the toolbox of that nurse scientist that allows them to then expand their frameworks and theories and, be able to better address the biobehavioral aspects of so many of the phenotypes that we're interested in studying. I think it's important that folks, realize that humans and the phenotypes that we are most interested in researching are complex, right? So, if you're conducting behavioral research and ignoring the biology of your participants, you really risk missing important behavioral components. And I would say equally so, if you're a biologist who ignores behavior and environment, you risk missing important biological components. So who better than nurse scientists with their holistic nursing lens to bring all of this together in a framework that is really not used by other disciplines. So I see that as being the uniqueness of omics within the context of nursing, is that we're adding it to these theories and frameworks that really help us better holistically look at these phenotypes, and take that holistic view that brings together the behavior and the environment and the biology. That's how you tackle these complex phenotypes.
Certainly. And I think that it's also important to state as well that I think coming from the genetics lens, I think also gives you a unique opportunity to emphasize some of those things to the students that you mentor. And partly why I say that, so I come from more of a behavioral science background, and I was always interested in behavior genetics. And I always found it interesting that we would talk about in like Psych 101, the nature-nurture argument. And I always found it kind of silly because the argument is settled. There's no debate anymore. It's both. And I found it very fascinating that the best people to make that argument that it's both were the people making gene by environment interaction papers, which were the behavioral geneticists. And so I think for you to come in, talk with nursing students and people doing biobehavioral research on this phenotypic end and talk about, you know, there are so many of these different factors. I think that's so important and incredibly interesting. So let's actually talk a little bit about your work, if you don't mind. So I'm very interested in your interests in identifying how the development of symptoms comes about from the omics work. Can you talk a little bit about what you're hoping to accomplish through your work in this area?
Right. So, I think that when we, you know, think about symptoms and we think about even, you know, co-occurring symptoms. So, you know, a lot of symptoms aren't occurring in a vacuum. There are symptoms that when we see one, we oftentimes see another co-occurring. There could be biological underpinnings that explain that co-occurrence. You know, if there was a biologic underpinning that was, you know, involved with depressive symptoms as well as anxiety, it would help us understand why these two things seem to co-occur very often. And if at the end of the day, one of the things that we're trying to do is figure out who's most at risk for developing a particular symptom, especially, you know, when we think about severe presentation of symptoms and the consequence of, you know, reduced quality of life as a result, if omics can help us better understand who's at risk, and then, you know, also help us understand, you know, how to, you know, the underlying biology, which can help us better develop interventions, both pharma and non-pharma interventions, to mitigate that risk. I think that's where we're trying to make our biggest impact. And, you know, evidence supporting nursing practice around symptoms is certainly gaining momentum. So the idea here is that we generate evidence that can impact nursing practice, which a lot of nursing practice is, you know, dealing with symptoms. So to me, nurse scientists tackling these issues around symptoms certainly makes perfect sense. And if genetics can help us better understand who's at risk to develop a symptom or better understand the underlying biological mechanisms that puts them at risk, and from there develop interventions to mitigate that risk, why wouldn't nurse scientists do that? Why leave it up to other disciplines to finish the story? So if you are looking at symptoms and not including a biological component, I think you're missing important chapters of that story. And to me, it's a missed opportunity to have nurse scientists who are expert phenotypers to not also collect biospecimens and address the biology of symptoms, because if nurse scientists don't tackle it, other disciplines are going to step in and tackle it for them.
Definitely. I wanted to ask you something as well, and I realized this as you were talking. It strikes me that there's this question of identifying where the individual variability comes from and kind of using that to stratify patients by risk and other categories. Mm-hmm. And that's such an important endeavor. One of the criticisms that I've heard, and I don't necessarily hold this view, but I'm curious about your perspective on this, about genetics and other kind of this enterprise is, what if we figured everything out, but you can't change someone's genetics? How do you intervene? What do you do? Like, what? How do you actually solve the problem if you identify at the genetic level what? I don't know if this is making sense because I'm not sure I can do that.
Oh no, absolutely. View absolutely. Justice. But. Well, okay, so then maybe a scenario might be helpful.
Yeah,
so
please.
Let's say we genetically figure out who's at risk. All right. Now, for development of symptom, let's just say within the context of cancer, right? So let's say there's a patient who's being worked up for cancer treatment. So they've had a biopsy done. We're looking at their cancer cells. We know that the biology of their cancer cells will tell us something about prognosis as well as how best to treat that cancer. All right, we've got that information. But then no one's worried about the symptoms, right? So now let's say we've got some additional genetic information where we can look at that person's cancer cells and say how best to treat them, treat that cancer. But when we look at their genetic makeup and we see, okay, if we treat them with this, they're at high risk for developing severe symptoms. And in that scenario, that individual might not be able to continue treatment. That individual might actually have symptoms that develop to the point where they don't adhere to their therapy. So if we have a menu of choices for therapy to treat this cancer based on the cancer's biology, and we know up front that this person's at risk for these symptoms based on their genetic makeup, you have a priori knowledge to add to those treatment decisions for that patient that could actually not only treat their cancer, but optimize their treatment experience through mitigating their symptom development. Or maybe there is something that we could give this individual that we know a priori is at risk for symptom development within the context of this treatment. Maybe there's something we could give them in parallel. If we know this person's going to develop severe nausea and vomiting, is there something that we could give this individual from the get-go instead of waiting to see what symptoms they develop? We could mitigate the risk of developing that symptom by honing their treatment, or in parallel giving them some adjuvant treatment that would mitigate the development of that symptom. But we can't give it to everybody, but we would give it to the folks that are most at risk. That's just a scenario that plays out in my head about how we could add to the information that we use to make treatment decisions for someone who is destined to undergo therapy for their cancer, for example. Does that help at all, Ian?
I think it does. So I was trying to do justice to this criticism, and part of what I'm hearing is that the criticism itself comes from a kind of naive misapprehension, because it assumes that what you will have to do eventually at the end of all this knowledge generation is some kind of gene deletion or figure out how to tackle the gene. But no, actually what you're saying is there's a host of implications on the environmental and phenotypic level that give you a range of different opportunities to intervene for that patient's symptoms in this case.
That's exactly
right. Did I get that
right? Right. So, you know, if the nurse is going to holistically look at a patient, why would you ignore that genetic variability that could help inform how best to treat that individual or what that individual is at risk for? We are not looking to change anyone's genetic material. And that is just one way of being able to use this omics information to improve care for our patients.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of my next questions I want to preface, because I know most very good, very productive researchers that I have met, yourself included, tend to be really just interested in like answering that next question, that next layer in their series of questions. Is there, though, kind of an ultimate vision for you of where you see, what's like the ultimate goal for what you're trying to figure out or to learn through your work?
Yeah, so I think, so, you know, you brought up behavioral genetics. What has that understanding done for those phenotypes? For one, it legitimized the fact that biology is as important as environment, and vice versa. And I think all these epidemiologic studies that come out and they link these environmental exposures to a health outcome, what's the link? What's the mechanistic link between those things? Well, a lot of that could boil down to omics. It could be, you know, epigenomics. The environment impacts your genetic makeup to the, you know, epigenetically, which impacts gene expression, which impacts health and wellness. I think my ultimate goal, and I don't know if this will be achieved in my lifetime, probably not, but we're setting the foundation here, is that at some point, if what they say is true, that you should be able to, for $1,000, sequence someone's genome and have that information present in their medical records, then why wouldn't we want to tackle the questions that are important to nursing practice that could incorporate that information into our future care, that if we were to look and see, here's an individual who will, you know, who is at risk for symptom development within the context of this chronic condition or treatment for that chronic condition, I'm going to take that information and I'm going to run with it. I'm an advanced practice nurse who wants to, you know, mitigate risk for symptom development in my patient. And how am I going to do that? Well, I have in my arsenal of information about this patient. I have information about their demographics. I have information about their personal history. I have information about their family history. I have information about the environment that they currently live in and maybe the environment that they were raised in. I have information about occupational exposures. I have information about their omic makeup. And I have all of these things. And with my holistic lens, I'm going to take from all this information what I need to better care for my patient. And I think that the omics piece is a piece that some of us are working on and that we hope is available to future, you know, nurses to utilize. And I'm just talking about symptoms, but we could talk about other phenotypes as well, but I hang out with symptoms a lot. So, but, you know, I don't know if that hits at what you're hoping to get at, Ian, but I think at the end of the day, it just improving nursing practice and using what we will have at our avail in the future. And do we want to miss an important component of someone's healthcare, their omic makeup? Do we want to ignore that? Or do we want to harness it and use it so that we can have better care of our patients in the future?
On the point about harnessing that, and you are now the second person to come on and talk about your work not necessarily being completed in this lifetime. It might take a couple generations of this kind of work. But on that harnessing this information note, I'm imagining the advanced practice nurse, you know, in their primary care setting, looking at these data, do you envision kind of an additional educational component for these practitioners to get them up to speed with this information? Or would this be like a algorithmically intertwined in their practice so that they didn't have to have this additional expertise? Like, how do you, I know this is all hypothetical, but.
Yeah. So I think there's a few things, right? I think there are always going to be some omics, some phenotypes and some omics that are going to require referral to a specialist. That I get. But as we see omics becoming more part of standard of care, that is where I think the advanced practice nurse is going to need this in their education. I think that if advanced practice nurses want to practice at their full scope of practice, they have to have this understanding. And I would appreciate them having it at the basic science level, as well as how it impacts care of their patients. And how that comes about, you know, it could be an algorithm at some point. We might be, you know, plugging a variety of variables that are, you know, available on our patients into an algorithm, and we get something that tells us how best to treat them. That day, you know, certainly could come where omics is embedded in that algorithm. But I do see moving forward that your better healthcare providers are going to be those that are educated in omics and have the ability to harness the utility of omics in their clinical practice. And I think we would want to ensure that advanced practice nurses have that information and are able to practice, you know, to the full scope of their capabilities. I see omics having to be part of that because it's becoming part of the standard of healthcare. It's already being integrated. Mm-hmm. Omics is already being integrated into the standard of care for a primary care practitioner.
I think I don't know why this jumped into my mind, but the first thing that jumps in my mind is ApoE4 for Alzheimer's is already on the minds of primary care providers thinking about, you know, future potential risk. And I am not particularly well-versed in that space, but that's, you know, I feel to your point about it being integrated slowly but surely.
Right. Well, think about that advanced practice nurse who needs to prescribe a medication that has a black box warning about genotyping. You would be remiss if you didn't incorporate into your algorithm for, you know, medication selection, as well as, you know, starting dose. If that information is out there about, you know, how to pick the best treatment and how to pick the best starting dose to mitigate side effects and optimize efficacy of that medication, are you not going to use that information? I think that would be a practitioner that probably shouldn't be practicing.
Yeah, I would concur. I would say that would be negligent in that case.
Negligent, right. But that is standard of care now. Mm. So how can we expect an advanced practice nurse to incorporate that into their practice if they haven't even had any education? You know, and I also worry about, you know, the patient who comes in and they have a report from 23andMe. And I know that that's, you know, again, that is a direct-to-consumer test and not necessarily clinically valid, but could be validated clinically. And if they have something that's red flagged in their health reports that they're getting from 23andMe, and that practitioner does not have the first idea what they're talking about, I think when patients know more than the practitioner, that's when we start to get into some trouble as well.
I like what you said about integrating this into the education as well. And I think that you would echo the sentiment of as early as possible, or maybe even in a BSN program, having some of this basic science. I think more and more schools are integrating it. And, you know, graduate programs like my own, for example, have some graduate coursework at the biomedical level, looking at genomics and genetics.
I mean, I absolutely, you are right. I advocate for it early and often, the education genomics. I would also say, if you are not incorporating, genetics as a basic science into your BSN curriculum, be mindful that those students are coming in with a fair amount of genetic knowledge from their high school science classes. Why would you not keep that momentum going? It's a shame if they were to lose that knowledge because it wasn't being carried forth into their undergraduate education as a future healthcare provider, to not have that basic science threaded through their BSN. And then when they get out and they're practicing, they're relying on their high school education in science to help them understand and be a better nurse.
Yeah, put that way, I think that will resonate with people. That's a pretty powerful way to phrase that. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. So I want to shift gears a little bit. I'm particularly interested in, this is my first time really having a nice in-depth conversation with you, but reading through your work and looking at your CV, I get the sense that you're very interested in connections between the genetic and genomic, all of the omics with the environment. And so all of the levels that are in there. And so my own interests really revolve around the same kinds of questions about individual variability and symptoms, particularly pain, especially headache. And for me, I've always been fascinated by how do we connect the genetic level with the neurophysiologic level, with the biobehavioral level, with the social level. And those methodological questions aside, you know, I kind of got a little bit of a taste of that in my graduate program before nursing. I started a PhD in behavioral sciences, and I really tried to focus on this neuroscientific question of how do these genes give rise to anxiety symptoms and depressive symptoms and things like this? How do they manifest neurophysiologically? And how is it different between different types of patients? And that was such a difficult question. And I see tendrils of that in your work. What are your thoughts on this question of like weaving together levels of analysis as a molecular geneticist?
Right. So, like I mentioned before, I think the behavioral scientist who ignores biology will miss important findings, and the biologist who ignores behavior and environment will miss important findings. So when we think about, so I think the important phenotypes, the phenotypes that are really impacting the public's health are complex phenotypes where environment and behavior and genetics comes together. And, these are complex underlying mechanisms. But I think at the end of the day, you can only do these analyses if you collect the data. Right. So when you say, bringing in that behavioral component or bringing in that environmental component or bringing in that, omic component, if you don't generate the data, you can't analyze it. Right. And so there's a variety of ways of analyzing those data and bringing them together. And they aren't always exotic analyses. There's some of the typical ways that we analyze data, but we're bringing in, an omics variable that might be, mediating or moderating a relationship between the environment and health, for example. There's ways of doing some of these without going into, exotic type analyses. But I would also say, to back up a step, we need nursing science to build good frameworks that incorporate all of these things together, and so that we all have common ground to work from, and incorporate all of these different pieces into our research. And, I I don't know if that answers your question, Ian, but I think we need frameworks that incorporate all of these things and theories that incorporate all of these things so that we sort of have a foundation that we can all build from.
Absolutely. I particularly appreciate well, a couple points. One, you said earlier in the conversation, which I very much liked, this idea that, you know, there's something that is mediating these environmental epidemiologic results that we're finding, and in all likelihood, it's some kind of omic variable. And so that's not a particularly fancy analysis. It's just a matter of, like you said, collecting the data or incorporating the data.
That's right.
And that's a good example of weaving together environment and phenotype and genes. And so, and you know, to your recent point about this, like, it doesn't always take some fancy bioinformatic, you know, Bayesian thing to do these kinds of things. So thank you for saying that. I do think that was helpful in getting to that point. So before we move on, is there anything that I left out about your work that you'd like to tell listeners? Anything that I didn't ask or touch on that would be salient to the conversation so far?
No, I mean, I do, want to make sure that I get this point across. I don't know if this is the right place to put it, though, but I want to make sure that it's said. I don't think the goal is that every nurse scientist needs to be a geneticist, or every nurse scientist needs to be a bioinformatics expert. I think what's important here, and some nurse scientists are going to want to lean more towards the genetics or more towards the bioinformatics, and that's great. But the majority of nurse scientists, what I think is most important to realize is that in order to be a principal investigator, in order to be a that PI that oversees a research project, that you want to conduct you want to conduct state of the science research. You want to incorporate components into your research trajectory that are going to get at the answers and test the hypotheses that are important to getting you to your goal for your research trajectory. And to that end, you need to do team science. And if it makes sense to have a biologic component to your research trajectory, no one expects you to be the biologist or the geneticist or the bioinformaticist in that on that project. You do what you do best and you lead that project, but you bring in co-investigators, you bring in consultants, you sit at the table with people who have expertise that you need for your research that you don't necessarily possess nor want to possess. And so the idea is team science. But at the end of the day, if you are a nurse scientist who wants to be PI of a project, and it makes sense to have a biologic component to that, and you don't at least understand how that component could improve your research, could have an could be impactful towards your project. Then I think that project is probably not going to be as stellar as it could be. So at the end of the day, we're not looking to make geneticists or bioinformaticists out of nurse scientists. What we are looking to do, though, is to have nurse scientists who have in their toolbox all of the things that are going to be needed to be a PI, run a research project that is state of the science, and at the end of the day, gets you to the goals of your research trajectory. So that was one thing that I wanted to make sure we kind of hit upon at some point.
Yes, long gone are the days where you're, you know, one lowly scientist in a room in a lab with maybe an assistant. And oh, there's so much that we've learned about how many people need to be at the table to really get at the right questions and then hopefully the right answers along the way. I really appreciate that. I just interviewed Angela Starkweather from UConn, and she alluded to the same types of things. I think for students listening who are interested in science, that's a really good point. And I particularly like that your comment on I do think it's important. There are going to be people who might get the false impression that in order to be a nurse scientist, I guess I also have to be a genetics expert. But to your point, yeah, exactly. You are laying it out. I think it's important for them to hear. They have to have a working understanding of the basics, and they have to know when to bring in that expert to the table, I think is what you're saying. Am I correct?
That's right. That's exactly right. And when output starts rolling out of that project, you want to be able to use your nursing lens to interpret these interesting findings and in collaboration with your research team. And I think that if you have absolutely no exposure to any of this along the way, that's where things will stall.
I'm glad you brought up bioinformatics as well. I did want to ask you about your perspective on this. You know, as a data-oriented scientist myself, I'm very interested in the different kind of lens that big data brings to the world of genetics and genomics work. How do you think about this in terms of the kind of nursing and symptom science that you work on?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things about bioinformatics is, you know, so we have all of this genetic data and we get this analytical output. Interpreting that, I think, is one of the areas where bioinformatics has been incredibly helpful to dovetail with genomics. And what we start to see is, you know, we have this connection, this genetic connection. And well, what does that mean? You know, what, at the end of the day, what does that relationship or that correlation or that association mean? It helps to get out into these databases that, you know, like these gene ontology databases where we can say, okay, this variation in the DNA we know is functional, and here's what happens when, you know, you get this allele versus that allele. So the bioinformatics capabilities nowadays that actually help us to be able to in silico look at how you know, be able to interpret our findings from all of this data that not only has been generated but is made available to us, that has moved along genomics just as much as the technology development. So the fact that we have these databases, we have data sharing, I'm a huge, huge advocate for recycling and reusing and finding new purposes for already available data. And I think there's a lot of data, big data, that's been generated out there from an omics point of view or even from an electronic health record point of view that would benefit tremendously through that nursing lens. There are questions to be asked, there are hypotheses to be tested that aren't being entertained by anyone else. That should be entertained by nurse scientists because they're bringing that nursing lens to bear upon this big data. That is where I think, you know, putting that big data to use, but putting it to use in a way that capitalizes on that nursing lens, I think is absolutely something that needs to be on all of our radar.
That dovetails very nicely with the first of my last couple of questions for you in closing. But before I go there, I want to just say for the listener who's not sure what in silico means, in silico is in like a computer model versus in vitro, which is in a petri dish, and in vivo, which is in the body. So anyway, not to derail us, but so one of the things I'm fascinated by asking nurse scientists, and I am particularly fascinated in asking a non-nurse scientist like yourself, with the unique perspective that you have, how do you choose to define what nursing science is? Like, what does it mean for you to be doing nursing research?
Okay, so this is a really good question, right? So, and again, one person's perspective. But, you know, if I were to define nursing science. I would say that it is a discipline that uses the nurse's lens and the holistic approach to health and wellness to generate frameworks and theories that can be used to generate the evidence base and generate multi-level interventions and inform nursing practice. So, to me, what goes into those frameworks and those theories that can be utilized, I think that there are going to be approaches and concepts that can be borrowed from other disciplines to impact the discipline of nursing science as well. I mean, there's no reason why we can't have frameworks and theories that have components that are, you know, specific to nursing science, but then also bring in some of those aspects of approaches from other disciplines. To me, that isn't being done by most disciplines, but the nursing science discipline with their holistic approach to patients and their phenotypes, I think, is an opportunity to have a discipline that benefits from some of these other disciplines. I think all disciplines benefit from each other, but I think what really makes nursing science unique is that those frameworks and theories are very much holistic, very much looking through that nursing lens, and very much able to impact intervention development at multi-levels, whereas I don't think other disciplines have as much of a chance to impact intervention across multiple levels. And it all comes down to informing nursing practice.
It really resonates with me. It's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about nursing and nursing science. It's very holistic and very integrative, and there are very few areas of science that are like this. And I think it's one of the features of what we do. So for people like myself who are kind of at the very beginning stages of launching a career in this area, and for people who are interested in something similar or akin to what you've done with your career, what advice do you think we should heed at this stage?
So I do share this with, students and colleagues that, I feel like some of what brought me here was just being open to opportunities. I don't think there were any geneticists with a primary appointment in a school of nursing before me. That is, of course, no longer the case, but I think that's an example where, just being open to new experiences. I think the other thing is you don't know what you don't know. So staying open and having experiences and exposures that maybe you didn't think you needed or wanted, but being open to those, you never know how that's going to modify your thought process and your trajectory. So I would say, one thing is definitely just staying open to opportunities, for sure. I also think that when you start your independent research career, you're going to be overwhelmed. I know when I became a faculty member, I had to do things that I was ill-prepared to do. What I was educated and trained to do, I wasn't doing anymore because that wasn't required of me as a faculty member. There were lots of things that I needed to start doing, and protecting my time to do my research was a struggle. But I would say always take the time to think. I don't, and I have to remind myself of this as well now. We spend so much of our time doing and not enough time allowing ourselves to think about that next step, to think about how would I do something differently, to think about something's not working, but so now what? I don't think we, especially at the beginning of our careers, allow ourselves enough time to think. And I think carving out time to think and being, you know, contemplative will pay off majorly as well.
Mm. I would like to follow up with two of those points, if I may, before we close out. And I know we're running out of time. So my first comment, I guess, I'm interested in one of the things you said about the things that you thought you were going to be doing when you became a faculty member sort of were not necessarily the same things. I've had many a conversation with peers at the medical school prior to joining the nursing program where, you know, we spend a lot of time pipetting and running PCRs. But then, you know, some of these people become faculty and they're like, you know, I'm writing all the time and I don't have time to think and I'm not doing any of the actual techniques I was doing. How much of that do you... I should say as well, the individuals I've talked to do believe that those hands-on techniques were vital in being able to help their lab staff actually, you know, get through some of the challenges that they run up against and things like that. But how do you think about protecting your time like that? And how have you balanced those things?
Yeah, yeah. And so I agree 100%. I think that, as a classically trained bench scientist, I, you know, as a faculty member started to realize I can't do everything. I can't be in the lab, you know, the way I used to be. So one of the things is, you know, of course, if you can, you know, hiring, you know, exceptional research staff is incredibly helpful to your career development, and being able to train them because you know what you want done and how you want it done because you can, because that's how you were trained, I think is very helpful. I also think that even in writing grants, my bench background helped tremendously in writing protocols and writing better grants. But you're absolutely right. As a faculty member, when you have to teach and you've never been taught how to teach and you have to, you know, sell your ideas through grants, which means I probably should have been a journalist or a marketing major, or I've got to, you know, take, you know, balance budgets or manage staff. These are all things that, you know, I think, you know, a lot of us weren't prepared to do. But I will say, protecting time, it's going to be relative, right? So everybody's going to be at a different place, and different places protect your time differently. I've found that one of the best ways to protect your time is to get funding to protect your time, because no matter what school you're at, they're going to respect the fact that you have effort on funded grants, whether it's, you know, a K or an R or, you know, something else. One of the best ways of protecting your time to do research is to get funded to do that research. And that will be for your entire career. At the initial stages, I think one of the ways, best ways to, you know, protect your time is to somehow figure out win-win situations. And what I mean by win-win situations is, if you can somehow dovetail your research with your service to the school or service to the university or service to the profession, dovetail it with what you're teaching, dovetail it with your clinical practice if that's appropriate for you, dovetail it with the students that you are mentoring, so that you have to do all of these things, but if they could be somehow relevant to your research trajectory in some way, then you sort of develop these scenarios where your time might be spent mentoring, or your time might be spent teaching, or your time might be spent doing service. But if those things are highly relevant to your research trajectory, it's a win-win, and it helps protect some of your time that way as well.
Great. And finally, I'm curious what, this might be a little bit of an esoteric type of question for you, but what does it look like for you when, once you do have that time carved out for yourself to be contemplative, as you said, what does that typically look like for you?
Yeah. So I always tell, students and trainees, this is the best job. Oh, this is the best job. Being an academic faculty member, where everything that you do, it's impacting your career, right? It's improving your career. You're expected to publish, but along the way, those publications are helping your career. You're expected to get research funding, but along the way, that research funding helps you do your research and also build your career. So I would say that, like, when it's a lot of times that contemplation is, concentrated when I'm writing a grant, for example. And if you're going to write a good grant, you've got to immerse yourself in the literature. You've got to be state of the science and up to date in this area. So you're going to spend some of your time doing that. And then thinking about, those specific aims and how you're going to accomplish them, being contemplating all of that. Some of that is I carve out and I justify that sort of time that I spend contemplating because, well, it's going to help me with the next grant. It's going to help me interpret my findings and the discussion of that goes into that manuscript. It's going to help that student defend their findings at their dissertation. It's sort of like, just having that opportunity to contemplate and to have academic discussions with other people. It's expected of someone who's an academic faculty member. And I think it's a great life to be an academic faculty member where, you're building your career and you're moving the science forward and you're doing it all while, supporting your family. And you will carve out that time to contemplate. And a lot of that for me has been around when I'm developing my science or I'm developing that next grant or I'm developing that next manuscript. Sometimes that contemplative time is built around some of those things. But you got to build it in somewhere.
Yvette, thank you so much for joining me. This has been absolutely a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Ian. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Clinical Appraisal. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share this channel with your friends in healthcare and review the show on your favorite listening app. If you'd like to donate to support the show, please visit paypal.me/clinicalappraisal. And if you'd like to ask a question or share a comment, or if I've reviewed a paper you are an author on and you would like to join me for an episode, please email me at clinicalappraisal@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you'll join me again next time.